The New York Times app has all this stuff that you may not have seen.
The way the tabs are at the top with all of the different sections.
I can immediately navigate to something that matches what I'm feeling.
Play Wordle or Connections and then swipe over to read today's headlines.
There's an article next to a recipe, next to games, and it's just easy to get everything in one place.
This app is essential.
The New York Times app. All of the times, all in one place.
Download it now at nytimes.com/app.
7654.
Big test.
3, 2, 1. How the mic sound?
Yeah, I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Staying alive was no job.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your preeminent ruckus of music, news, and criticism. I'm John Caramonica, a critic at the New York Times.
I'm Joe Coscarelli. I'm a reporter at the New York Times.
And I'm Bobby Diggs, a.k.a. the resurrector inside your sector, the abbot of the Wu-Tang Clan. Welcome to the podcast.
That's right. That's exactly right. Bong, bong.
You know what I mean? Making my way on fire skates. No question,
I was speed for cracks and weed. The combination made... Today on Popcast, we are talking with the RZA, the abbot of the Wu-Tang Clan, the architect of the Wu-Tang Clan, one of the most important figures in hip-hop from the 90s moving forward. They are about to go out on what is going to be their final tour as a complete group. 30-plus years after the group's debut album, they are going out on the road as a unit. It's the last time they will all be on the same stage, traveling the world. Joe and I spoke to the RZA last week. We talked about what it's like to gather all the members of the clan under one idea of reuniting for this final tour. We talked about Wu-Tang's influence dating back to the 90s, the path that the group had to take when the conventional hip-hop paths were not made available to them. And also, we talked a little bit about what it's like to make art that flows out into the world and also to lose art that people never hear. Let's get into it. The RZA is here. We have a tremendous amount to talk about. One of the true legends of hip-hop, of pop music history. I know when I say that, it sounds huge. It sounds vast.
Grandiose.
And I don't mean to age anyone in the room, but when you've been doing big things for a really long time, sometimes you have to step back and admire the scale of it.
Yeah, age is good. People always say you're getting older or you're getting old. You only got two choices in life.
Mm-hmm.
You either get older or die.
That's real.
And let's get as old as you can, bro.
Trust me, I'm working
on that. As, even if you're 100.
Uh-huh. Get older.
I'm sure you're going to be like, one more year ain't going to hurt.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Keep simmering.
Yeah, let it go.
And now we have this tour that you guys are billing as the final Wu-Tang tour.
Right. So now we're announcing to the world, Wu-Tang is forever, but we're announcing the final chamber.
Everybody's going to be...
Everybody.
Every day.
Everybody has agreed.
Everybody's agreed. Yes, which is not nothing.
No, everybody has agreed to do this.
Yes.
Everybody's agreed on the name. Everybody's agreed that, yo, let's... To put it in slang terms, let's run around the globe one more time together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One more time, let's run around this globe. You know, so we may come to your city and you'll see all of us together. And that might be the last time you see us all together in the physical.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You might go watch us on TV mm-hmm. or this, but we're not coming to your city again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what right. I mean? It's like when we come to your city and you see these 9 men and they're coming to shake your hand one more time. Yeah, that's something special.
As you started to move the chess pieces of this sort of nostalgia moment for Wu-Tang, were you imagining the next steps already as you were 25, 30 years ago when you started this Wu-Tang journey?
Yeah, to be quite frank, you know, it all was part of a plan. It was so in the beginning, there was a 5-year plan.
Okay.
Yeah, break it down.
Yeah, speak on it, yeah.
The first plan, which was documentary mm-hmm. to get to the series. Right. Then that's going to build up to the first tour, which was New York State of Mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to then build up to a residency, but a test run first.
Mm-hmm.
And then that'll lead up to a tour,
mm-hmm.
a final tour.
Right.
Right. And then after you complete that, if you succeeded in all those steps, then you can potentially sit still at a residency and ride it out.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So that's a business structure. Using my art, using Wu-Tang Clan, using my brother's talent, using my relationships and the expertise of what I've learned, that's a strategy to be like, okay, if we follow this, right, and we win, this is the end result. And we've been blessed to be on course.
Everybody agreed off rip when you laid that out. Was there anybody who said, I'm not ready for the nostalgia run? I'm not like, I'm still vital. I'm still putting out records. I can't look backwards.
Or was the plan only up here?
No, the plan was verbalized, but I don't know who understood it, who didn't understand it, because
right.
It wasn't a Congress Senate gathering plan. It was like a meditation for myself and then a presentation of here's the plan.
You're in this period of life where you've done a lot of looking back. You're always creating, you're always making new stuff, but you also spent some time over the last 5-6 years really thinking about the legacy of what you built with Wu-Tang and making sure it feels like it was correct in the public record. Like, when did you first start to think like, hey, I've been moving forward for 25 years, it's time to glance in the rear view a little bit?
For me, far as looking back, it was when other outlets started showing hip hop and they started looking back. And when they was looking back, it was a TV show on Netflix, I think Hip Hop Evolution.
Yeah, sure. That documentary series. Yeah.
And I was like, hold on, they kind of skipping some shit. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
It's funny how that happens.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, no, we can't let that happen. Uh-huh. We can't let it be skipped. You know, you miss a layer or you miss a pillar of something, then the foundation is going to fall. So when I realized that part of what was being skipped was, you know, our story, the Wu-Tang story, and what we helped bring to the culture of hip hop and to even pop culture, if you want to dissect everything, it was important for me to take charge and be sure to tell the story. And tell it the way I thought was best. Mm-hmm. If you notice, I told it with a documentary of Mics and Men when got Sasha Jenkins to direct it. And he actually also was very adamant about who tell the stories. Mm-hmm. It was, let's tell the documentary regardless of anybody's perspective. Right, I let everybody's perspective exist.
That's
even
my
though
next
I didn't
question.
Agree.
It's funny because that's...
Then the second layer was, and then let's tell it through cinematic.
Right.
And that's when I... the Hulu series.
The mini series.
Both of those ideas and both of those activities were parallel.
Right.
It wasn't like do one, do another. It was like, I'm going to put my creative spirit, my creative mind, and my business acronym and... everything that I got to make this come to reality,
right,
and team up with the right people and put a lot of strength on it, a lot of focus, and bong, bong, did it.
So one thing, I feel like when you read about how like all the Star Trek stuff works or all the Star Wars stuff works, there's always this kind of master narrative. Like everything has to make sense with everything else. Like if there's a book, the detail in the book has to line up with something in Return of the Jedi, right?
And big Star Wars guy over
here. I'm just simply saying, I'm a big process guy. So one thing that I've been thinking a lot about in the wake of the documentary series, the Hulu series, You God has a book, Raekwon has a book, Ghostface has a book, you've had your books. Mm-hmm. There's got to be things that disagree.
Yep.
And I wonder, especially given how you were in the early years, where you're like, it's my ship. It's like, I'm in control.
You've called it a dictatorship at times.
But
given that, what is it like to let all the separate narratives live? Because there's got to be stuff in Ghost's book that doesn't line up with something in the Hulu documentary or in the Hulu series or vice versa. You have to accept that on some level. Yeah. But I wonder what that process of coming to terms with everybody else's narrative.
It's a two-step process. One, let me do the first step, which I'm going to do. It's going to sound egotistical, but it's not egotistical. So even in the Bible, you get the four Gospels. And they're different, okay? And this is what we base our Western religion and culture on.
Sure.
But yet, one God said this.
And the other.
One God said that. Mm-hmm. So even in something like that in scripture, you find that, right? So then when it comes to Wu-Tang, for me, as I matured, I realized that that perspective is different. Like right now, in this room, as we're looking here, You see here, you see it, but you don't see that cactus behind you.
Right.
And you might not never look there to see it. I'm like, yeah, we was in the room and had the cactus. You're like, what fucking cactus?
Right.
It was an orange New York Times thing right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm nah.
It's Rashomon, right?
Right. But the truth is still the truth. So perspective is not truth. Perspective is how you saw it. And so, as Inspector Deck said, hit you with 360 degrees and form a circle. So hit everybody's perspective, then we get the circle.
Mm-hmm.
Then once you get the circle, you could then distill the reality from the fact or the fiction or from a misinterpretation or whatever. But it's beautiful to me to allow the perspectives to live. And I didn't understand that at first.
Were there any quibbles? Because you're always going to have quibbles of perspective. Were there quibbles of fact that you're aware of?
I mean, it's going to always be that too, because the Wu-Tang in one capacity, and I'll say any family.
Sure.
Let's just say that any family in one capacity is singular, right? You could, I don't know if you got brothers and sisters.
I do not, but this, you know, we have this.
You may say some shit that you swore you said and he said it, but he said it, but you was there.
Yep.
And now you're telling the story. All of a sudden, you're in the driver's seat.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But you wasn't driving. But in your mind and your convincing of life and your perspective, it's like, yo, I was driving. You go, no, I was driving. I was, well, we was in the car.
Right. We can agree on that.
Okay. And we got there and we had a great time. So that's the reality, right? Mm-hmm. The truth doesn't need proof.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
But it's also when you're dealing with memories of 30 years ago, sometimes the actual truth is unrecoverable. Like all you have are collective perspectives.
No, don't say that because
you got a lot of tapes.
Right? One thing that we talk about Wu-Tang, we're talking about history and talking about art and books and documentaries and all that. Everything that we do, even right now, our podcast, this is for entertainment purposes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You will get some information in this, but we're here to entertain you.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So within that entertainment, there's art. And within that art, there's the objective and the subjective.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Creative license.
Yeah, and you got to respect that. And then when you look at Wu, you're looking at lyricists.
Mm-hmm.
So even
storytellers.
So even when Ray said, I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Here we are now at the New York Times. This is before we would probably even imagine that we'll be part of the zeitgeist of the New York Times.
Sure.
You could open up a issue or article and bong, here we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? In a negative light sometimes and in a positive light.
Sure.
You know, it wasn't like our journey was all positive, right?
Right.
So to me, that's the beauty of it. But I never, I don't take it personal. I don't take art or business personally. You know what I mean? Business is business, art is art. Personal is, you know, if you just put your hands on me. Mm-hmm. That's personal.
Right.
If I put my hands on you, that's personal.
But there's no anxiety when there are those sort of potential moments of friction or disagreement or cross-purpose understanding. It doesn't cause you anxiety.
No. And I don't think it caused my brothers that either. Like,
I mean, look, if you look at the actual composition of Wu, it's both family, actual family, but it's also close friends. Like, so, you know, these are people
it's
from your childhood. This is your childhood and teenage years made manifest as adults. Is it unusual to be pitching a plan to a manager as opposed to pitching it to your family member or pitching it to your friend?
No, because business is still business, right? You're dealing with success.
Yeah.
Right? So it's just like, yo, you know, Ghostface has a plan. For Ghostface, you know what I mean? For his children, his family, his art, his sound. He might be like, yo, I'm doing the wizardry of poetry, yo.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not into all that shit right now. So because of the ability for everyone to do what they're doing and to have their management, their team, their little staff that depends on them or their family,
mm-hmm.
It has to be cohesive and also, what's the word, conducive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
It has to be conducive. Like, okay. And so what I strive to do is like, look, here's the plan,
mm-hmm.
right? Part of the plan will take, will require them. Part of the plan don't require them. But you have the ability to give as much as you want.
Well, you might as well start practicing now.
We will be right back after this with more from the RZA.
Welcome back to the temple of hip-hop and swore temple, lyrical rhyme info, b-boy Bob Digital, diamond crystal rings, solid gold bone rituals, we be the humble most calmest individuals, hard to spot micro dots, we side squat, stomp.
My name is Audra Diaz Birch, and I am a national correspondent covering race and identity for the New York Times. Race coverage is complicated. It can be joyous and affirming. It can be uncomfortable, but I feel like it's still absolutely necessary. Race and identity are not just understanding who you are, but who the person in front of you is, and wanting to understand more about them. We're trying to wrestle down these really hard subjects and maybe not answering the question, but asking the right questions and listening, listening a lot. The Times is dedicated to ambitious and deeply reported coverage of race and identity, and they're willing to back it up with resources. If you are curious about the world in which we live, if you're interested in who you are, where you come from, and how you relate to others, I would encourage you to subscribe to the New York Times.
So we're talking about the tour and this sort of final tour, and you use the word conducive, which I think is a really potent way to think about it, because you have to somehow have everybody be on stage at the same time, convinced that being on stage at the same time is the best idea for them.
Exactly.
So you made your pitches, and eventually now we're on the cusp of it.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what you imagine that's going to be like? Like, talk us through, like, who's going to be there?
Okay.
What is
as much
it going
as I can.
And how do you think this tour experience will be different from any of the prior Wu-Tang tour experiences, which, as you mentioned, have been a rollicking ride?
Wu-Tang hasn't been a big touring band, if you really go back and check out history, right? Once we had made success, especially once we got to 1997 with the Rage Against the Machine tour, we actually walked off the biggest tour in the world that time, right? Without remorse.
It was maybe the most powerful thing you could have done in a perverse, counter-narrative way.
Say why, briefly.
No, why? Because a lot of us weren't prepared or engaged in what that was. It didn't, you know, it was counter to what some of us was feeling, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I think the foresight wasn't there for some of us.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing I could say is that the 5-year plan that came to an end.
92 to 97.
Yeah. So it was like it was like I couldn't enforce it. Like it was like, okay, that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was a great idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, it ended up being me and Zach on stage one night.
just you and just Zach.
Zach's leg was broke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it got deep.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So all of Wu-Tang was went their separate ways.
It's just all getting soggier and soggier. But point being, maybe we weren't a touring band.
Right.
We, in those days, our money came from the studio, came from the system, it came from the
making
labels.
Albums and getting advances and
go
royalties.
Go get your million dollars, and that's, hey, that's good life, right?
Right.
So we didn't really start touring until, first some of the guys was touring without me, like in 2010,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? And I joined it, and it was very uncomfortable.
Mm. Because you were, why did it feel, because you weren't steering?
It is just, it wasn't the quality, the level. The level of it, yo.
Yeah.
It was.
It felt thrown together, slapdash?
It was soggy.
Soggy.
Yeah. It was soggy, bro. Mm. And it was like, you know, I was like,
it's not for me.
Yeah. But I could make it better if you guys want me to kind of put my chi on it.
Yeah.
And then so I did put some chi on it. And
we
it
often got, find ourselves saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Let us put our chi on it.
Exactly.
It'll get better.
And it got better. And so then we had some successful touring, right? But not at the level of still of what the brand is and what the band meant to culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I eventually had got with my team at CAA and was like, how would you guys like to represent Wu-Tang?
Mm-hmm.
And I bring the whole team over.
As a full entity.
And had some good people at CAA, and we took a shot, and we brought it up to the level it needs to be. So then the first really big tour that's like cohesive is my buddy Colin Lewis at Live Nation. We had a great conversation. Was like, yo, let's do a real tour.
Mm-hmm.
Wu-Tang and Nas.
Yep.
You know what I mean? New York State of Mind.
Yep.
And I said, call it New York State of Mind. And everybody's like, why New York State of Mind? That's a Nas song. I said, no, because that's the state of mind we want to bring. Okay? He may have coined it. Actually, Billy Joel, but
we'll give it to Nas for now.
Nas of his day.
For the purpose of this situation.
I'm always saying that.
No, he is. No, I'm a big Billy Joel fan. But point being made is that let's do that. Talk to Nas. He was like, yo, great. And we did it. And it was a very successful tour.
Who was on that tour from the Wu?
So it was the Wu-Tang, but every member wasn't there.
Right. Who was there and who wasn't?
Meth missed a big chunk of that tour. Jizza was in and out of that tour. It was rotating. Right? It was a consistent six members, but we had some rotation going on.
Sure.
And for the fans, you show up and you don't know who you're going to get. It's a dealer's choice.
Yeah. And I don't like that, to be quite frank. Even though the music speaks for itself, you know, it's amazing to look at 9 artists, gold and platinum, all in one family.
Of course.
Backing each other up, dropping every bar and every verse. It's something amazing about that.
And also, you know, there are people for whom they love Wu, but like Deck is their guy.
Yeah,
they love Wu, but RZA is their guy. And if they show up to the Aspen, Colorado date and their verse is not there, it just doesn't hit.
Yeah,
doesn't
it's almost like, yo, somebody didn't put no salt on it.
It's missing some seasoning. Some
So, but on the second New York State of Mind, it got tighter. Still had some fallouts, right? But most importantly, though, it was successful. And so success breeds success. You know, there was a time where, you know, I don't know, I just wasn't feeling it. And it was almost 2 years. I wasn't feeling it, so I was cool. And then it was like a November after Thanksgiving or something. This is probably like 2016, 2017. Something just, I felt it. And when I felt it, I actually told my wife, I said, I feel kind of good. I don't know if I came back East Coast and kind of started feeling it. And then Raekwon had hit me up and was like,
you put your Timbs back on.
Put my Timbs back on.
Yeah. I said, you came with the Timbs.
Raekwon hit me up and was like, yo, I'm doing this documentary. I would love for you to be a part of it. You know? And I was like, no, what? Yeah.
Yeah.
I could come there tomorrow.
Yeah.
He was like, okay.
Yeah.
And I came there tomorrow. And from that day forth, I was good. You know, so, but if you'd have called 2 weeks earlier,
no,
because your spirit got to be right. And I think our spirits are right.
The era in which you got famous, when you went on the Rage Tour, there actually wasn't an equivalent hip hop only tour that you could get on.
Right.
Because hip hop touring in the 90s was not that solid.
Business,
no one, I mean, it could have been a business, but the touring agencies, the venues, it wasn't lined up like that. It was perceived as such. And then what's interesting is when festival culture started in the mid 2000s, a lot of those festivals were like, well, everything but rap.
Right.
That's nice, but we'll have Bjork. But we're not going to have, you know.
Yep.
And so there are all these windows where people are making a lot of money on the road. But I think you're right in that it's really not until the late 2000s into the 2010s where people are like, you know, where there's a lot of money on the table. What if we get everybody we love from the 90s from hip hop and put them on the road? And then that audience is matured and they can afford the tickets and so on and so forth.
And the 50th year anniversary was a big blast for the culture.
Sure.
You know, seeing a lot of great legends come back out and able to go and make business with it, you know? So that's why we want to run around the globe one more time and show something, right? And I think the most important thing that we show is the blessing of through all the things we've been through.
Yeah.
Time and music and art and family, we still have the strength to come together for the sake of our music and our fans and present ourselves. And present ourselves well. You know, it won't be nothing soggy.
Right.
I can tell you a funny story.
Yeah.
So on the New York State of Mind tour, on the first night or two, you know, we haven't been around each other, right?
Still a little frisky.
Yeah, and we didn't get the rehearsal. We got one rehearsal, and then the next night it was a show.
Right.
And it was in Indianapolis, which is not a crazy, you know, crazy hip-hop town, right?
Tough crowd,
right? Like, out of a 16,000-seater, it's only 10,000 people there. You know what I mean? So it's not even a sellout capacity. Yeah, sure. But anyway, our chi was off. Our sync was off. And that's a fact. And we had a locker room moment. It's more like a four-hour locker room moment.
Team meeting.
After?
Yeah. And we, you know, and my brother Devon was there. And Devon, he doesn't hold his tongue. Mm-hmm. He's like, y'all was shit. Like, basically.
Yeah.
He was like, yo.
Get in the gym.
Yeah, he was like, yo. And who, he was like pointing out everything. He told me, you got your arms out, no muscles.
You know, he's like, put some sleeves on.
Put the sleeves on or hit the gym.
One or the other.
You know what I mean? Like, yo, what you doing? What y'all doing?
And he broke that down for everybody, basically.
Yeah.
And how, you know, did people take it?
Some walked out, some cursed, some came, walked out, came back. Mm. You know what I mean? It's like walked out and came back. Like, you know what? He's right. And two nights later, the next night it got better. Then the third night, it was, okay, that's the Wu-Tang.
Right, sure.
That's the Wu-Tang.
Sure. Just took some reps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You got to get those muscles back. And that's how it is, right? But point I'm making by sharing that is that when you are good and great, right, and you keep those muscles going and you present that to your audience, it's a sight to see.
Of course.
Nine great motherfuckers going into their shit, even at the age, right? And so that's what we want to do right now. As I'm announcing this tour today, my official announcement, I talked to AEG and I talked to our management team, like, yo, let me holler at everybody, make sure everybody's in.
Right.
You know what
I mean? The right headspace.
Yeah, and bung bung.
So who are the hurdles? Because we're 5-10 years after, you know, you guys getting back together and start touring. Older, everyone, family, business, as you say, different priorities. Like, who was there a holdout? Like, tell us the story about getting the band back together.
Yeah, it's always, you never know who. That's the point.
Right.
It's like, you'd be like, I got every, this guy. Yeah.
Snuck out the back.
The thing you could do, though, right, and I'll just speak business, is really just simply ask everybody, like, what do they want? What do they need?
How What's it going to take?
How does it work for you?
Yeah.
Time-wise, you know what I mean? Dollar-wise, comfortability-wise, you know, somebody might have been like, yo, listen, I don't want no more than two people in the dressing room with me. Mm-hmm. Okay, yo, could we work that out?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, what other kind of requests? Like, anything surprising to you when you said, we're going to do this, and then one of the guys hits you and said, we'll do it if...
No, it wasn't nothing surprising. I mean, when I got to be quite frank, it wasn't nothing surprising. It was more like, I'll take this to myself. You know, I can be very... Look, I'm a film director, showrunner.
Yeah.
You're the boss.
You're used to having things your way.
That's not a personality that you gotta have humility with.
Yeah, control freak, some might call it.
I'm speaking for myself here. Yeah, so look, some might call it. Some might, the know-it-all, right? So I do have...
We got three in the room right now.
Okay, at least. All right, there you go, man. Well... And that's an issue sometimes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And when you're in that position, you got to realize that the sum of the whole outweigh the parts, right? And so I think for me, it was more, you know, I said what Method Man said to me one day, you know, like he said, you always talk at me.
Yeah. That's a challenge.
You know what I mean? And then when I...
When and I, what did you say?
I just listened. Like, and I always ask my wife, like, what do you think about
what'd
this?
What'd she say?
You know what I mean? She's like, you could be that way. I said, all right. I said, you know what? So then I said, well, let me just ask him what he want.
Right.
And then when I asked him what he wanted, he said what he wanted, and we was able to make that happen. He didn't tell this to me directly, but he told it to someone else who came to me third party. He was like, yo, I appreciated that he approached me as a businessman, as an individual. Not like, you know, I'm not a, you know, I know he's the abbot, but shit, I'm a general.
Right, right. You know? He's not the employee and you're the employer.
Nah, that's not the party. That's not the party.
Right.
And I know that, you know, but as the abbot, sometimes it's still your destiny to be the best Noah. Mm-hmm. It's still your destiny to be like, oh, this is what we need to do. This is the time for it.
Trust me.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And But trust is one thing, love and trust is another thing. But then also just making sure that everyone is satisfied in their journey, sure, and getting on this journey. You know, the last brother I had to call is my teacher. The last person I had to call was the Jizza. And the Jizza is my teacher. So he could do almost anything he want and I can't say nothing.
Right. That's the person that the abbot has to submit to one way or the other.
And he does it too. Like, if that was the Jizza, nothing I could do.
So right. How'd he react?
Huh?
How'd he react?
He said he's in.
Mm-hmm. But you were prepared for a no?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I called them directly. Also, like, I didn't.
No manager to manager.
No manager to manager. You know, I called a few of the brothers directly, regardless, you know. But for him, I was like, yo, because he didn't make the Vegas shows. And whatever reason, that's his reason. I don't need an explanation from him.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? I won't, you know, like I said, he's my teacher, so. What's it? Give me an explanation.
Yeah.
That ain't happening. And I revere him, to be quite frank.
Sure.
But I was like, yo, you know, we about to do this last joint. And I, you know, want to know, you know, are you interested in it? Do you have the time? Here's the time. Here's the flow.
Right.
Okay. Here's the business potential. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You could finish the nooks and crannies, you know, with your team. But are you in?
Spiritually speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, I'm ready.
Good.
I was like, that's a blessing.
It's an impolite question, but is anyone pick up the phone and say, yeah, well, how much is so-and-so making? Like, how much is the equality of the money?
That hasn't happened. Issue? Look, that could be happening on the managerial level.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But
because there is a hierarchy, I assume.
No, there's a hierarchy. But I do think that at the end of the day, it's almost like one thing that the team was able to do was whatever everybody was making on New York State of Mind.
You can improve upon that.
We have improved upon it. You know, if you get a 10% raise, that's cool. If you get a 20% raise, oh, how about that? Don't bank for a 50% raise. That's now. Right. Now.
Now we're talking crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Now you're straining it. I mean, no lights. Okay, we need lights.
Yeah. Have people accepted where they sit on that hierarchy after all these years? Like, do you feel like it's, A, do you feel like it's fixed? And B, do you feel like people know where they are in the power rankings?
I think that's a good question. I don't have the answer to that, right? But what I will say is that I think that everyone can measure their own equations as they go out to face the world alone, mm-hmm, and see their value. And then if they come back to Wu and that value is at least that or better,
mm-hmm,
you can measure. If that value is less,
right, then you have a problem.
You got to have a problem, yeah, right? So I just use a simple term. If I'm making a dollar by myself and then I go with the Wu and I make $1.25, I'm not even $1.05, but $1.05 might not move me,
right? Because when you're on your own, it's your rider, it's your dressing room.
$1.10 might not move me.
Sure,
$1.25, let's move, baby. Sure. Let's, and I get to see my brothers.
Yeah, we have a party. You know,
it's like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the equation that everybody looks at it. And I think, you know, there was one point my brother Divine, when he was head of the business, because he was head in 2017, and then I asked him to, you know, step aside and kind of let me, because it was such a, he's such a dominant, he's a Leo, mm-hmm, so Divine, he don't, you know, he's coming hard body on you, mm-hmm, and we needed some diplomacy, and also not taking nothing from my brother who really helped us get to who we are and helped me, like my brother is actually the guy that when I wanted turntables, he's the guy that hustled in the streets and bought the turntables.
Sure.
And let me, now I'm in the crib all day. Me and ODB, we not hustling. We funking up the room, making music.
Yeah, of course.
While he's out there risking his life. So he's always been that yin and yang for me. And when he got to the business, he became the CEO of the company, right? Mm-hmm. But at that time, I was like, you know, let me guide it. But he was like, hold on, I pulled everybody Polestar.
Mm-hmm. Let's see the figures. Let's see the touring figures. Here's how much so-and-so made last year.
He put the pole stars on. He was like, yo, look what you.
Yeah, right. He's moneyballing the situation. Yeah, he's like, the trades say you're worth this.
Yeah.
But you're like, let me work it from an emotional angle.
Well, I respect that.
Yeah. Are you guys on a bus together?
There was times, yeah. Not now.
Not these days.
No. Now it's like, there's so many damn buses, bro.
I can't even imagine the buses.
It's a traffic jam just the...
Bro, that New York State of Mind tour. First of all, New York State of Mind, you got Wu-Tang Clan. We had Busta Rhymes the first year. Yeah. And Nas, right? And the way those buses are pulling up, it was like a car show. Mm-hmm. Then somebody may have the double. People was balling their buses.
Comparing buses. Yeah.
I actually came with a pretty nice bus myself.
What's the best feature on that bus, of your bus?
My bus was killing because I had the both transformed in the back. I had the front and back transformer. Mm-hmm. But mine's already had the built-in little dressing room.
On top of that.
So I had the stylus.
On the bus.
So I ain't on the front. When that first tour, and I was coming out with the gear, some of the Wu brothers, because they wasn't kind of getting the gear, they kind of was keeping it classic.
Yeah.
They was like, oh, shit, the Abbott trying to smack some shit on
us. He didn't come to play.
Yeah, and I was doing it, to be quite frank, I do my shit just for inspiration.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? If you catch me normally, I'm just cool. I could wear the same pants every day.
Yeah.
But when it's time for art, and it's time for entertainment. It's like, nah, it has to have a magnetism.
It has to have the character.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something, I was going through old transcripts of times when I spoke to you, like in the late 90s and early 2000s. And one of the things that you talked about was obviously how important Wu-Tang was to developing character in hip hop. And there were a number of things that we now take for granted in hip hop and pop more broadly, that when y'all were doing it, you were doing it first. And it was untested waters. It was untested for someone to be like, I've got three alter egos. Right. It was untested.
or six or 20.
It was untested to be like, we're going to tour with a big rock band.
Right.
And in a way, you missed out on like the golden era later of hip hop touring because it came too late, but that kind of forced you into unconventional strategies. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about stepping into the breach, you know, in the 90s and being like, well, damn, there isn't a way for us to do a big tour unless we go with Rage and All the White Boys. And then what's that like? Can you talk a little bit about the uncertainty of stepping into those moments?
Well, first, you know, being a pioneer of something, right, was actually the aspiration of me and ODB.
Okay.
Like, so of course Jizza is our teacher, but me and him had this aspiration. You know what I mean? Like to carve our own path.
From the beginning, you knew that was the idea. Yeah. You didn't happen upon it.
Yeah, it was like, it was aspirational. And it was like, you know, people are joining Wu-Tang.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Wu-Tang is me, Ghost, and Dirty.
To start, yes, right. And they knew what they were signing up for.
Yeah,
they were
signing up for that. Definitely. There's no record deal or nothing. I mean, just join it like, yo, homie from Park Hill is a Wu-Tang member.
Right.
He's talking Wu-Tang slang. He's rocking with me. It was like the idea of it being something special and being almost mythological superhero and all that, that was like the aspiration of it.
Mm-hmm. That was the blueprint.
Yeah. So then now you're successful with it, and now what's your outlet going to the touring? And no, there wasn't no touring like that, but there was club dates.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And your club dates in colleges and all that's fun.
Yep.
And you can make some cheese like that, mm-hmm. but you're not going to make it to the top of the food chain.
Sure.
Like that. Mm-hmm. And so my idea, along with Steve Rifkin and Rich Eisenstein, we talked about it. It was like, yo, Wu-Tang would Rage, right? Go out to the world. This album, I'm going to tell you a story. Yeah. I was in Manhattan for whatever meeting, and I kind of was near a payphone. Mm-hmm. And I hear this kid on the phone, little white kid,
mm-hmm.
right? And he says, he's talking to his parents, whatever, mom, whatever. But I overhear him say, yeah, New York is good. Mom, the best thing I saw, there's a big Wu-Tang sign in the Times Square. And I said.
This is like mid-90s.
Yeah. This is like the Wu-Tang Forever.
Yeah. So 97. Yeah.
So this guy said that was his most exciting moment.
Of the trip.
Of his trip. And here's a Wu-Tang guy 5 feet away from him. dressed regular, but he don't, you know. But it was, so I was like, oh, shit. That meant something to me. Mm-hmm. And so when it came time for the Rage tour, it was like, nah, we go. There's a lot of white fans out there.
There's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands.
That are ready for us. You know what I mean?
That was your light bulb moment for that?
That was more like a convincing moment for me, yes. And so my pitch to the team was, we go here first in the summer. And then on the four homecomings, we go back and get the blacks. Mm-hmm. But that didn't feel good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because when you out there, you Raekwon the chef, or you Ghostface Killer and shit, and you know, you want your bitches and you want your shit. And and not taking nothing from them, but you young. And you want to feel
a certain kind
that hip hop thing you get when watch these rap niggas get all up in your guts and bitches is like that and the bitches got on their rings and they fly shit. You want to see all that. You want to see the Benz pull up. You want to see all your homies, man. You want to see that shit
reflected back at you.
Yeah, because that's how it was.
So you came up.
Yeah, that's 95. That's 96. Mm-hmm. When Cuban Links drop and you go to Philly, all the ballers are there. Mm-hmm. Right? We doing Rage Against the Machine. We ain't hitting Philly. We hitting Camden.
Different energy. It's not the same.
You know what I'm saying?
Not the same.
But it's 30,000 people there.
Right.
Some people took to it and some people did not take to it.
My best thing, I had a talk with Questlove, really explained it better to me. Mm-hmm. Because after Wu dropped, they put the Roots on.
Yeah. On the Rage tour.
Yeah.
Instead.
Yeah. And he said that tour ended up buying his first house, and it changed his life, he said. So he thanked me.
He thanked the Wu for falling apart. Out, right?
But one thing he said that stuck to me that I didn't consider, he said he was scared out there.
That's interesting. Why?
Because it's mad people out there. And here you are playing music. Like for me, that's an adrenaline rush for me. But for some people, It's nerve-wracking. Mm. I just watched the Stax documentary, and Isaac Hayes said he was wearing his shades as a security blanket. I said, holy shit, I thought that shit was cool.
Right, but he was protecting himself.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So you don't never know. So when Questlove said that, I said to myself, maybe some of the brothers didn't feel it. Maybe they were scared. Maybe because the audience is 50 feet away.
Yeah.
They're not
up on the stage.
Right.
The energy of it is very different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess it took time for us because when the New York State of Mind tour ended, nobody wanted to leave the stage.
I bet.
I'm talking nobody. Nas, everybody goes. Everybody was like, they didn't want to go. I was like, oh, now they get it. And it was, we was playing Sheds.
Sure.
So it was the same thing, basically.
Right. We've talked about this present moment of Wu-Tang, dipping a little bit back into 97. Like, can we hit you with a few other Glory Days questions? Because I'm thinking about the Hot 97 band. Mm-hmm. And Wu-Tang going to play Summer Jam, big radio station concert. And I think people of the new generation don't realize how much power rap radio had at the time. Like, you know, you go out there. I mean,
it was the power.
They had all the power. I mean, talk to me about the fork in the road of that moment. Like, what happens to Wu-Tang if you don't get banned from Hot 97?
If we didn't get banned from Hot 97 and their sister stations and even a few other stations that followed their trend, it's almost like, I think Wu-Tang Forever, you know, could have been Diamond.
Wow.
You know what I mean? I think like, and other albums that came, I mean, we continue with albums. I mean, you figured after that, Capadonna comes, right? And he gets a gold album, but
with no support, like no.
Exactly. I mean, Bobby Digital, no support.
And that was at a time when pop rate Z100s of the world weren't playing hip-hop like that. You know, we're still a few years away from that happening. So all of a sudden, there's no outlet.
Raekwon's second album, GZA album, Ghostface, Supreme Clientele. Supreme Clientele got minuscule play. And you know, Hot 97 apologized to me like 2 years ago.
Yeah, how and when did you squash it?
Like 2 years ago.
Wow. That's crazy. 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
2023.
When we did the Madison Square Garden thing with them.
Wild.
You know, we popped up on them. They apologized. And Funk Flex, you know, sat down with me and apologized. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And, you know, and even, you know, I won't go too deep into it, but even some of the adversaries who said, yo, we were sabotaging y'all, they told me. Said, we purposely sabotaged you. And I'm so naive to failure, right? Or so, when a person told me that they did that intentionally, I was like, yeah, you kind of fucked me up for like 2 weeks.
I bet.
And that was it. Because my destiny is my destiny. That's me. My personality is, I'm confident in what I was born to do. And so, to me, it threw me off for like 2 weeks. But then after that, it didn't even matter. Because it's like, the world is big, bro. But that was a kick in the nuts. And in hindsight now, it was a kick in the nuts to the culture.
Well, I wonder what you think about, because we're talking 97. So what you're right on the cusp of, obviously, 97 is a huge year. You know, Biggie's second album, we lose Biggie, Pac is just gone. But what we're really on the cusp of in the late 90s is the beginning of the real rise of the South. And obviously, you get into the early to mid-2000s, you have 50, you have 50 and Ja. It's not that New York is gone, but it's not the same.
Exactly.
The energy is different, and all of the kind of, like, cultural power has reorganized around Cash Money, No Limit, Texas, Florida, Atlanta. And I wonder, do you think that Wu-Tang and Wu-Tang, sort of all the tributaries being minimized, in a way left space? It created
it left a lot of space
first
for of
other
all,
people.
If you go back and look at, and first of all, it's hats off to them because their destiny is their destiny, right? But if you go back and look at the Wu-Tang empire, right, with the Wu-Tang Clan and all the solo members having success, Sons of Man, Killer Army, all these different, this hip-hop of New York, right, all, you know, having a potential to continue the rawness of hip-hop, the Gravediggers, all these different chambers having the chance to get stopped, okay? Mm-hmm. And then another wave come in, and they come in to New York. You know, and they come into New York radio, and one degree is great because the South culture gets a chance to rise and those families, you know, get a chance. You know, when I went to New Orleans in the 90s, I almost cried from the poverty.
Yeah.
Seriously, I was like, oh, I thought I was, their poverty is deeper than our poverty. You know what I mean? And then the you know, New York, the education, you go, New York, you go walk down the street and somebody is going to have a book on, like, people sell books on the corners of New York. You could pick up a book and learn business and this and that.
Sure.
Out there, it was economic deprivation and educational deprivation. So when they got theirs, it's like, it was a blessing for hip-hop to give that to them. But still, all the culture could have grown. What happened is that the New York culture, right now, everybody's chasing something to make you dance, something to make you dance, something that that has maybe talking more to the girls or whatever. And you're missing Obama atomically, Socrates philosophies and hypotheses can't define. You're missing that brain stimulation is going.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And it happened. I do think that halt on us, it also halts a lot of others. So Nas make it through. Like you said, 50 make it through. Ja Rule come through, but Ja Rule come through once again. Hook, melody.
Yeah, it's singing. A different energy.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's like, it's funny because I remember first engaging with the No Limit stuff in the mid to late 90s, and there wasn't, like, there's not a Wu-Tang Clan of No Limit. They're all solo or group acts. But I remember the family energy of being like, and it's like, if you like this one, if you like Fiend, you'll like Big Ed. If you like Big Ed, you'll like P. You'll like True. And it's, to me, I was like, that's very Wu-Tang.
Right.
That's it's a Wu-Tang idea.
Well, the model Well, the model of Wu-Tang has been emulated.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Everywhere. Right? But the lyrical content.
The substance
of Wu-Tang hasn't.
Yeah.
No disrespect, right? The model, yeah, we've made the model.
Yeah.
We've showed that you can come in collectively, simultaneously,
yeah,
right, and spread your culture. You know, when Native Tongues were Native Tongues, that was different. That was getting different deals and then coming together.
Right.
We came in like, here we are.
Right, there's no Native Tongues record deal, right, group, album.
Right.
It's just like a bunch of people that hung out together had similar and way became of thinking.
That, yeah.
Right.
But still very pioneering. But still, point, yeah, that was a big stop, right? And at the end of the day, like Questlove said, the Wu stop opens up for him. So the Wu stop opens up for others. And so the others, to me, that's the blessing of the Wu.
Yeah.
Like, I was thinking about this, and I'll share this on this podcast, on this podcast.
That's right.
I was thinking, like, I said to myself, the Wu is actually a bridge for hip hop. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it should be recognized as almost as a pillar, one of the pillars. I found them fathers, of course, Herc and Flash and Melly Mel and Cold Crush and Fantastic Five, Funky Four, you know, Fearless Four, you know, Sugar Hill. We could go through our forefathers, you know, Run DMC even, right? Then we got our uncles, meaning those who were almost our peers, only a few years difference from Rakim and Kane and KRS and them, right? When we came, we shift the dynamic. Mm-hmm. We actually make... If you go back and check a lot of the records that's not radio played, mm-hmm, it's not going to sell a million records.
Mm-hmm.
We actually are allowing you to sell a million records being you.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't happened, right? And then now it's opening it up. And then it also opens it up, right, even for international, you know?
That's what I'm saying. Like, all these paths that you ended up having to take because the center was not available,
yeah,
end up becoming totally normal to, yeah, everyone else, yeah, 5, 10, 15 years later.
Yeah.
And I think it's almost undervalued. Like, when people talk about the 90s and they say, hey, you know what? Death Row, that's the thing that broke, right, it open. Bad Boy, that's the thing that broke, right, it open. Whatever. But to me, Wu-Tang moving in all these different spaces, and then eventually, like, the fact that you could sit with Quentin Tarantino, right, at a certain point. Now, every rapper's like, oh, I'm making a movie. Oh, I'm worth this director. This guy loves me. But when you did that,
it was pioneering.
No one was doing it.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that period of time when you were able to leverage, like, I'm the RZA. Like, I'm the RZA. I got some rooms I could get in. I want to be in these rooms. Tell us about that, and especially with the film stuff and Quentin and all that.
Well, thanks. Well, also, it's not that I was leveraging myself. It's almost like my mission, first of all, as an artist, my mission is to live art. As a hip-hop artist, my mission is to spread hip-hop and show the hip-hop community that there's many ways that we could exist. And then as a Black artist, right, my mission is to show that there's no boundaries either. And in all those artists' natures of me, I'm super confident that when I step into the party, give me my moment, it's going to be a party. And so when I entered Hollywood, I didn't, you know, I entered just being me. I think it was Harvey Weinstein had a movie, him and Quentin bought Iron Monkey.
Yep.
They was like, yo, we need somebody to market this thing. Like, who's going to market a kung fu movie in New York City that's going to the theaters? And they reached out to the Shaolin Temple, and they was like, oh, what, there's a student there, RZA. Oh, the RZA from Wu-Tang, he can market it.
Perfect.
And I was forgetting, and they offered me like $60,000 or some shit. I was like, I don't need your money, bro. I saw that movie 5 years ago. I love that, right, film.
Mm-hmm.
So you could donate it to the temple or something,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But I said, all the thing I request though is lunch. He said, why lunch? I said, well, you and your brother, I said, Harvey Weinstein and his brother, Bob, right? they are like Warner Brothers. They pioneered two brothers. Warner Brothers, two brothers started in a barn. Those two brothers started Dimension and Miramax. Me and my brother started Wu-Tang Production. New Yorkers, let's have lunch. And we had lunch. And then after we had lunch, we...
And now you wish you hadn't.
Yeah, but... different times.
No, we had lunch. Nothing happened to me. Okay?
Different era.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a good lunch. but point being made is that then he introduced me to Quentin. And then we just hit off like buddies. That's the same likes, the same coolness. And then we started watching movies together. You know what I mean? And when he come to town, Miramax would let me use the screening room. And we could watch a movie there.
Something way out of print. And Quentin's like, you got to see this, man.
Yeah, or something. Oh, yeah. Something,
or vice versa.
Yeah, vice versa, right? And then that just led to, you know, I'm in L.A. Oh, I'm showing a movie up at the crib. And I got my new script. I would love for you to read.
Yeah.
And I read it, and it was Kill Bill. And I was like, wow, this is great. But the thing that attracted me, because what happened with me and Quentin, I told the story 100 times, but I just said on your show as well, is that I saw in him a creative bone that was in me, but I didn't know how to define it or how to polish it. And I simply asked him, yo, can you help me kind of understand this? And he said, yes. You know what I mean?
Because he saw it too.
Yeah, he definitely saw. I mean, he definitely, you know, he loved Wu-Tang. And said, he's, you know, he Bobby Digital, he dug my art. So that was that. So it was always coolness and that. But he also, he's a generous teacher. You know, that's why you could see him when he talks. He's generous with his wisdom. And so at the time, you couldn't just get it anywhere. You got to go to his house and get it.
Yeah.
And I went to his house to get it. And I mean, I went to his house dozens and dozens of times and watched so many movies. He let me look at his library and everything. And I just studied. But then the point came, it was something that we was all talking about that ended up like kind of assimilated into some of his work, right? That was great. Like he took the letters and made a word. And I was like, well, that's deep. Then he's like, yeah, a writer takes and absorbs. And then he told me, you should write. Write your own movie. And I said, write my own movie. And I had the book from Soviet, right? And I just kept going. And so that's what led to that. And then eventually, of course, I write Man with the Iron Fist and get it made.
You're talking about writing as a collaboration, and that makes me think also of Wu-Tang. Like in the documentary, you know, ODB gets out of prison and you're helping him write verses. Like you guys are sharing lines, you're writing for one another. And this is something that obviously goes back throughout hip-hop history, whether you're talking N.W.A. or whatever it is. But it's also, I think, especially in the new school, controversial, right? Oh, ghostwriting. Like, oh, RZA's ghostwriting for ODB? Like, you could hear somebody not schooled in the tradition saying that. Talk to me a little bit about your philosophy in terms of sharing bars and writing together as individuals and as a group.
Well, I think the foundation is you should write your own lyric, right? But I think writing your own lyrics is different than writing a song.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so a song everybody could chip in. You know, Raekwon had his verse. He wrote his own verse for Cream. Deck wrote his own verse for Cream. But if Method Man went and wrote the hook, it wouldn't have been a song.
Yeah.
Right. So I think when it comes to writing a song, it's cool. But for most of Wu-Tang lyrics, I'm gonna say almost 90%, every individual use their own pen.
Sure.
That 10% comes if somebody is stuck, lacking, need time, didn't have the exact experience, or like when Ghost was writing All That I Got Is You, he came to me because he knew that he had six brothers and sisters. I come from 11.
Yeah.
And so he was like, yo, let's talk about some of the things.
Common experiences.
Yeah, so the one thing about the four in the bed, and then somebody pees the bed.
Right.
Right?
But he took that and applied it to his situation.
I would say 90% of a Wu-Tang is his own thing. And then there's a 10% of us helping each other when that was needed. Like, I think there's a line, I got one line on the Wu-Tang Forever album. That's an Inspector Deck line from an unreleased rap that he had on the tape when we was kids.
I just remember,
something like he said, "Oh, leave your brain in the fog." I said, "Oh, it's yours." He had it on one of his old lyrics. No, 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 I leave your brain in the fog. And I was doing, no, and leave your brain in the fog, tossing back to him. And then you may hear him throw one of my lines in.
Back at you.
Because that's like almost like we're complimenting each other by doing that. But I was going to say this to answer your question. The ghostwriting is two different things. Ghostwriting is somebody's writing all your shit and you're acting like it's always you.
Right.
That's ghostwriting, right? That's like, but Shante said this to me as a kid. She's like, Diana Ross don't write her own songs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, most of our great, even Michael Jackson, a lot of those songs are not written by Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm. Frank Sinatra,
et
cetera. Whitney Houston.
That's why it's a songwriters. That's the job. So I think it's okay. But in hip hop, let's say like two rappers that's battling. Now you're battling me. Now you're going to have him write your battle.
Right, then that's a different energy.
Then you're not battling me. Right. I might as well just battle with him.
Yeah. All right, before we get to the lightning round, can I ask one, just for the heads, a nerd question?
Okay.
It's two parts.
I got one too. You go first.
All right. Obviously in Los Angeles, you just had the fires and people lost a lot of things at a personal. Mad Lib lost his entire library. You very famously had a flood in the early years where a lot of old stuff never to unreplaced and I assume not backed up was gone. I wonder if you can tell us anything about what was in that flood and does it ever pop back into your head? And the second part, and this is just a sidebar, I interviewed you many years ago for an oral history of Raekwon's Only Built for Cuban Links. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about Nas on Verbal Intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
And you said in that interview that there's actually a second Nas song that you guys did in that era that didn't make that cut.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that song?
The Nas song has to be on some tape somewhere, on some 2-inch
You don't
somewhere.
Know where it is.
So it has to be on some,
okay.
Somebody got to have those masters, right? Should be me, but I don't keep control of the my brother Divine probably got the.
But it exists.
Yeah, Divine probably got it in a vault.
It's somewhere.
It exists.
There's a copy.
It definitely exists.
It could happen. We could hear it at some point.
Very possible.
Okay, just noting.
And then for the first one was the flood. Yeah, the flood destroyed a lot of things. A lot of my beats were made on floppy. Was on floppy disks back
then.
This
is what year is the flood? This is.
I had two floods. The first one is actually 93, after Wu was out already, and I'm making Meth album, and then Deck album, and just all those albums was already pre-made, and then the flood washed all that away, and I had to create it, recreate. But here goes something cool about that. So the floppy disk all got damaged in the flood, so you can't put. I put them inside the machine.
Don't read.
No, don't read. I still have the floppy disk.
Wow.
And on this tour, I'm going to take these floppy disks and I'm going to put them in something and maybe somebody in the future could figure it out.
I mean, I feel like the technology is probably much better, like the saving.
Yeah, like this Beatles song that came out last year, they couldn't get a usable version of it to work on until they had the technology that they used for the Peter Jackson documentary. And then they used it on the John Lennon demo. And here we are, a Beatles song nominated for a Grammy in the year 2025. So,
but maybe there's technology now that can rescue those discs that wasn't available.
I got them. It's about 80 discs.
If anybody is hearing this and wants to help you,
but
I'm
going to take those discs and put them in something. I mean, like I'm going to put them in a time capsule.
Oh, you're
going to
just let them
and then whoever, whatever. But we'll talk about that on a different day.
Okay. Did that cross your mind though with the fires, with people losing stuff? Like, have you spoken to Madlib about losing all these?
I spoke to him, but you know, I was out there doing the fires, and we had to evacuate as well. Threatened to be evacuated. Mm. The winds blew it away from us. But the only thing I grabbed was my hard drives, which is crazy because my wife was like, what do we take?
Right.
And I was like, I guess we could just take our laptops and our hard drives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's kind of weird that I thought of that.
Yeah.
But that's how seriously.
Probably sent you back to 30 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. To be quite frank, brothers, I've lost way more than I've shared.
Sure.
And that's just how life is.
Right.
I mean, but I've been blessed to share what has provided, you know. Can I point out one thing real quick?
Please.
So hip hop has saved a lot of families. We know that.
Of course.
And then I look at Wu-Tang itself, right? So first, Wu-Tang saves, of course, me and my family. I got 11 brothers and sisters and all these nieces and nephews. And we've been able to, nobody never had an empty refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
But we grew up welfare kids with just a block of cheese in the refrigerator. So it saves, but then it also saves Method Man's family, O'Dirty's family, Raekwon's family, and all the way down to the whole rest of the clan. But then it also saves and piss economics and their managers. It piss economics and the engineers. It piss economics. It's just continued to economically feed so many families and communities. You know what I mean? And to me, that's the blessing of hip hop. And that's the blessing of when that Wu came to the system, right? If you see somebody like Jay-Z was like, yo, I got the blueprint from you. That means the Wu is doing what it's supposed to do.
Right, because it's Jay Rockefeller.
And then somebody said to me recently, somebody who was mad at me, he had one of my colleagues, and he said to me, are you mad at what I did? I said, no, I'm not mad at what you did. Because you did something that benefited your family. He did something that was kind of like whatever, but he gained something from it for his family. I said, is your wife and your kids all happy right now? I said, yeah, that's what the Wu was about. Forget how I personally feel.
Right.
Okay? Personally, man, we don't got to talk for a year. But if the Wu was able to feed your household, you know, when I was doing my movie, Man with the Iron Fist, there was 400 people working for me. That's jobs. When we did the Wu-Tang series, right, shot right in New York and New Jersey, we shot on Staten Island. We was able to bring computers, iPads to schools. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, the series, just to be quite frank, the series, you're talking about $300 million being spent on communities, on families. Now you got actors who, this actor becomes a millionaire because he's playing this role. So that's my goal, right? To do as best as my blessings can do to multiply my blessings. And you asked me earlier, like, why this or why the Hollywood thing? Me, I'm leaving footprints, kid.
And that's sort of what I feel like I was trying to get at, which is that at the time, living through it, I remember watching those moves and they seemed so improbable when they happened, but right. Then a few years later, it seemed inevitable.
Respect.
And that to me is the real gift of Wu-Tang in that moment, is that you looked at a playing field that was not built for you. And you said, fuck it. Like, we're going to go here. We're going to play it this way. We're going to try out here. We're going to put ourselves in maybe a unfamiliar situation and make something of it.
And then the footprints is there, and other dudes can now, instead of trying to think he's going to be a hip-hop producer, he'd be a composer.
Exactly.
Instead of being a composer, he writes a jingle.
Exactly. Right?
As you see my new voiceover.
Yeah, for the Beats commercial, yeah.
Hey, do voiceovers, kids.
Let's take it back to 79. I bomb atomically. Socrates, philosophies, and hypotheses. Can't
the back in a minute with me, Joe, and the RZA.
Perform armed robbery, flee with the lottery. Possibly they spotted me. Battle scarred showgun. Explosion when my pen hits. Tremendous. Ultraviolet shine.
All right, lightning round. We got 52 cards, 52 questions. We'll do 5 of these and then get you on your way into the cold. I did want to point out, you're very much dressed for the New York cold. Is this because you've been in LA too long? And then every time you come to New York, you're fully bundled, well, even when indoors?
Hey, you know what I mean? When I get here, my closet got the gadgets.
That's what I'm saying. That's what the New York closet
look,
is.
Look at it.
Yeah, I know, literally. All right, let's grab...
Pull a card. Let us know what you got.
All right. I got number 7.
7 of?
Clubs.
All right.
Joe, you got it?
All right. Tell us about your first car.
Oh, I bet that was a good one.
Oh, my first car was, it was called the God Mobile.
All okay. Right.
All right. It was a 4-door, feel like it was a 4-door Lincoln something.
Like one of the big body ones?
Big body,
like
4-door car. Joints. Used car.
Yeah.
We bought it. All the girls made jokes. The girls called it the God Mobile because all the gods always used to be in it. And I remember just one day driving in it, and it had the girl found the mouse in the back. It was that big. It was a mouse living in that motherfucker. Yeah.
Your first car had mice.
Yeah.
What color we talking?
Brown.
And it was like
the mouse or the car?
Car. It was ugly, bro.
And it, but it was one of those huge cars. Was it like kind of like heavy because it was heavy. So big?
Listen, I don't want to talk about my new film yet. I'll come back and do that.
Okay.
But I actually had the art director get a car similar to it just because of creating my own thing with
sure.
it. Yeah. Nine of Hearts.
All right, here we go. Nine of Hearts. Who's your OG? Who do you turn to for advice?
Nowadays, I guess nowadays, I have to just go to my father. My father's 82 now, and he's, it's a joy talking to him. You know, we spent a lot of years not talking, maybe up to, my 40s.
Really?
Yeah, because we had,
While you were taking off, contact.
We didn't spend a lot of time then, very few times. But that's my man, my best. My best. And I'm fortunate. I have a wife and I also have my brother, Devon.
Of course.
Yeah.
A question about with your father. Does your father communicate with you as the boy who has not yet become the RZA, or does he communicate with you as the adult who has lived this life?
The adult, but he also can go back. Like he'll tell me like things about me that he saw.
That, before it all.
Yeah, yeah. He said something. He always said, you was a brain baby. Like, because you would eat everything, but never grow. It's like, and they call it, he said, down south, they call that brain babies.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
wow.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Four diamond.
All right, we got four of diamonds. What's your first memory?
Wow. My first memory is... the first thing that popped in my head, my first memory is my grandfather's birthday. I was 3 years old and they had a cake. And the cake had flowers on it. Mm. And I was like, why is there flowers on a cake? Mm. And I threw it across the street. I was with my cousin Zach. And
the whole
I was,
cake?
No, my slice.
Oh.
My slice.
You like, I had flowers enough for eating?
Flowers on a cake didn't make sense to me. Second memory is my father holding me in his arms, breaking up the furniture before he left. That's my second memory. Just get you two for one.
Wow.
Wow.
All right, hit us with two more from the deck.
Oh, six of spades.
Six of spades. In what ways are you still immature?
This is the therapy portion, even though it's the fun portion, but it's the therapy portion.
I mean, I still like to play with toys, right? In all reality, yeah. You know, not just like as far as video games, but it's just like playing is good, and I still play. Yeah, I still play like Kung Fu, you know what I mean? Now I get to play it with my grandson, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And
grandkids.
Yeah, I got a grandson. So I get the, I got grandchildren, pardon me. I get to get a sword and get to go ahead and go and play. So that's
beautiful. Yeah. All right, last one.
Nine of club. We got two nines in the building. All right. Seven of club.
Nine of clubs.
This is a good one.
Some more therapy. Does any part of your body cause you stress?
No. Pretty good.
Do you feel you're still in good shape?
Yeah. I mean, this one shoulder right here, if I don't work out and keep exercising, it'll let me know. Because Tony Jaa put a move on me when we did this film, and he gave me a lifelong injury.
Really?
Not intentionally. He told me that when he do it, I got to just... I didn't tap out. I tried to be whatever I was trying to be.
So you do your own stunts.
Whatever. It's Tony Jaa, bro.
Yeah, you got to be there.
Right?
Yeah.
No, I'm just saying, don't take him as no joke. This guy's a master. And he threw it. I didn't, when you watch the movie, it's called The Protector 2, you'll see my face.
And you're like, oh, that hurt for real.
That was for real.
We're gonna pull that clip.
Yo, you'll see my face. When he threw that shoulder move on me, it's never been the same.
Wow, incredible.
But again, do your own stunts.
Exactly.
Comes with the territory.
Yeah, exactly.
The RZA, what a joy. Really appreciate you
being here. Thanks for inviting me, and I'll see you brothers in the future.
Happy to have you. That's our show. Every episode of Popcast is at nytimes.com/popcast. You can see this and all our other interviews, Bad Bunny, Andre 3000, Jelly Roll, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. YouTube.com/popcast. Subscribe anywhere you get your audio content. That's Spotify, Apple, so on and so forth. Thanks to the whole team who's here today. Thanks to everybody working on the episode remotely. We'll be back next week.
Bong bong.
I thought it was gonna get deep.
On which stuff specifically?
That wasn't deep enough for you?
You want more?
We can keep going.
Oh no, I got it. Yeah.
What were you thinking? Like, what were you anticipating?
A few G's a week. My click used to sum up till my brother got locked up. My girl got knocked up.
You know, they found the new particle, they're saying now. You seen this new particle?
No.
That if it spins in one direction, it generates mass, but if it spins in the other direction, it doesn't. In a Yamaha 4-track,
the bass from the lab used to blow the... That's where you wanted to go with this thing.
Think about it. What's the weight of a thought? It gotta have a weight. It's energy. Man radiates thought like ice radiates cold.
Okay, here's the thing. Does a thought in and of itself have weight, or does it merely alter what's around it and then change the thing?
That goes back, right? That's both right. That's two questions.
But that's what I'm saying. Which is it? Does the pure thought in the thought itself? Right. Got capping them. Status on the map in them. Brooklyn do it bombing them. All around the world, killer bees start swarming them. You can't stop us. You can't block us. Rock us or mock us. Knock us or top us. Better sit back and watch us. Okay, we are going to close out our time with RZA, as is our tradition, by trying some snacks. But first, here are the credits for this week's episode. Our audio producer is John White. Our editor is Brendan Klinkenberg. Our audio engineer is Alyssa Jane Moxley. Our executive producer is Jen Poyant. On the video side, our video editors are Jamie Heffetz and Pat Gunther. Cinematography is by Elliot DeBrun, Jamie Heffetz, and Sawyer Roquet. Our senior producer is Sophie Erickson. Our executive producer is Brooke Minters. Special thanks to Nell Galogli, Mahima Shablani, Michael Cordero, Craig Hedich, Maddie Maciello, Amanda Webster, Lindsay Flood, Pedro Rosado, Karen Gans, Saya Michael, Nina Lossom, Brad Kimbrough, Katerina Clarici, Andrew Wilcox, Solana Pine, Paula Schumann, and Sam Dolman.
All right, before you go, every episode of Popcast, John and I, big snack heads, we always try an exotic snack to give it a rating out of 10. You, not really a snack guy. I hear you eat pretty healthy.
Pretty healthy.
You're vegan?
Yeah.
How long?
Decades.
Yeah, there you go, decades. Yeah.
Like strict, that. As long as you can remember.
Yeah.
All right, so we got you a plant-based candy. This is Sweet
Haven. We're an accommodating podcast.
Chewy Tropical Mix Peach Mango and coconut and passion fruit vegan snack.
I'm going to say this before I eat it. Yeah. It don't sound good.
No, don't sound good at all. Sound good, but no, look, here's the thing. You got to rate it with your heart. If it's a zero, it's a zero. We're not in bed with big snack. We don't care.
All right. We got peach, mango, or coconut, passion fruit. You want to pick or you want to go blind?
Let's go blind.
Blind. All right. I'm going blind. Go blind.
We'll go blind.
John will go blind.
Okay.
All right. I got a mango.
How do you know what you got?
It's on the wrapper.
I got a peach.
I have coconut passion fruit.
The craziest thing is I actually don't like peach candy.
Uh-oh.
Oh, so we're really...
You want to try a different one?
Oh, okay.
This is like pretty rock hard for a chew.
It's a chewy?
You got to chew it first to make it chewy.
Mm. I mean, definitely stale, first of all.
Yeah. But you know what?
It's like a high chew.
Yeah. You know what it tastes like?
Mm-hmm.
I mean... You definitely don't have no fucked up teeth either.
Yeah.
No, you're going to lose.
Knock up a good teeth. Mm-hmm. Bad teeth. Builds up a lot of saliva. You notice that?
Oh, yeah.
And making your mouth work.
Talk about wetness.
Yeah.
Jesus.
But
not bad, actually.
Not
once
bad.
You get through the shell.
Yeah. Once you get through that carnauba wax. Mine's is pretty good. I don't like peach.
You want to try the mango? I got it.
No. This is pretty good, I got to say, because It tastes like the popsicle, the creamsicle.
Creamsicle.
Tastes like a creamsicle.
Okay.
Interesting.
And I like creamsicles when I was a kid. How do you taste?
I like the flavor, but the chewing experience is so laborious. Mm-hmm. It's like a good snack has to be efficient. Mm-hmm. It's a snack. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying.
Sometimes I like to work first.
I'm not. I got things to do.
You're not a pistachio guy?
No. I got things to do. I got places to go. This is, I'm going to give this a 5.5. Mm. I think the flavor is strong, but I feel like I'll be chewing this. Like, long after you've left the building, I'll still be chewing this.
I'm not going to finish it.
You're done.
I have to be funny, but look.
It's still chewing.
I've been chewing it for 3 minutes.
And look at it.
This shit is still...
It's bigger now.
Somehow it grew. Yeah. I'll give it a 6. I like the mango. I'd eat more of those. I'm going 6 out of 10.
I'll stay at 6 with you, right? And I'll say because, I mean, if it was smaller... Mm-hmm. They should make this like more like Tic Tac size.
Okay. Right. Exactly.
And then they might have a business.
All right.
Do you have a preferred vegan snack? Like, while we're here, is there a vegan snack that people should try?
No, I can't really think of one. That's just get some cashews, bro.
That's exactly right.
I love cashews. I love walnuts. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? In my car, I get in the car every morning. Slice. He'll have bananas, oranges, and, my favorite snack is pistachios.
There you go.
That's a very Joe snack.
Okay, thank you.